Withdrawing his blade from the corpse, Doc cleaned the Toledo steel on the animal's fur, then again on a bit of cloth from a pocket. Visually inspecting the long shaft for any damage, he returned it to the ebony sheath of his walking cane, where it snapped tightly into place. Watching the interior of the supermarket for any further movement, Jack cracked open the cylinder of his Colt Python, pocketed the spent .357 shells, and thumbed in fresh ammo. Retrieving a dropped clip for the Uzi, JB stood and tucked it away.
Never seen this type before.
The filaments of her hair waving about in agitation, Christy clicked shut the reloaded cylinder of her SMW-38, tucking the blaster in a holster at her hip.
Thankfully, these wolves are a lot easier to kill than those hellhounds we encountered in Ohio.
Jack rubbed a set of parallel scratches on his throat.
Yeah, easier ain't easy. Bastards fast.
Mildred walked over and took hold of his jaw, turning the teenager's head to inspect the red marks on his albino skin.
Didn't break the dermis. You should be okay. But let me clean it so you don't go septic.
Opening her bag, she anointed him with a splash of alcohol. He gingerly touched the scratch.
Thanks.
Just be glad it didn't chew your ass.
Mildred grinned. Brushing the snowy hair off his face, Jack snorted in response. The distant rumble of an approaching storm sounded in the cloudy sky as Dean picked up the ejected brass from his blaster and dropped it into a pocket for later reloading. One of them seemed bent, which meant it was useless, but he could check on that later. Carefully, the boy inspected his Browning for any signs of fouling from being dropped in the sand, and when satisfied, he inserted a fresh magazine. Snapping off the safety and working the slide, the boy walked away from the group and stood guard at the corner of the intersection. Ryan retrieved his rifle from the ground.
Mildred, check the bodies.
Kneeling at a warm corpse, the woman displayed a bloody knife.
Already doing that.
Good.
Brushing the sand off his dropped rifle, Ryan worked the bolt, slid in a fresh clip, and slung the weapon over his shoulder. Then, checking the area, he noted that Dean was already standing guard, without waiting for directions. He felt a rush of pride.
JB, Doc, wreck the market. See if there are any more of these bastards around.
Or supplies.
Doc eased back the hammer on the Lama as the armorer pulled out a Gren. Together, the men stepped through the broken window and into the grocery store. JB pausing at the registers to let Doc proceed, then the old man doing the same at the head of the first aisle, as JB crept past him in a standard two-man defensive rotation pattern. Outside in the Hummer, Christy pumped the gas and tried to start the engine.
Slick move of the wag, Christy. You okay?
It took two tries before the big power plant caught.
Fine. Just angry that they got so close before I saw them.
As she backed the wag away from the brick wall, the wolf's body stayed where it was, as if nailed in place.
Headlight's broken, so no more night driving until we can replace it at the redoubt. Pop the hood.
Christy did, and he listened to the humming engine.
No real damage. Thankfully, the army built these things to take damage and keep going.
He closed the hood and latched it in place. A whistle heralded the appearance of JB and Doc from within the pre-dark store.
Clear. No more wolves, not even cubs. However, nothing much was usable on the shelves. All of the cans are empties, just there to make the store look like it's full of goods. It was expertly cleaned out long ago.
Doc lifted a plastic bag of bottles and glass jugs.
This was all we appropriated. Some grape preserves, Band-Aid bandages, and a few odds and ends.
I expected as much, but it never hurts to check. Stow it away, and check the side streets.
Doc deposited the bag of food carefully in the cargo area of the Hummer, while JB climbed into the wag and set the safety on the M60 before easing off the bolt. The military blaster was 100 years old, and even though it was in perfect operational condition, it wasn't wise to keep tension on the firing spring. Otherwise, next time he used it, the weapon would break, becoming a 22-pound paperweight. A brisk wind formed little dust devils on the street, the miniature tornadoes twirling madly before slowing into non-existence.
Storm coming. Real soon.
Yeah, I know. How's it going, Mildred?
The black woman ran her hands over the corpse of another wolf.
This is the last one to check.
Not all of the beasts had that third eye of a mutant. Carefully, she inspected its forehead, teeth, eyes, then legs, bending the joints to observe the configurations. Satisfied for the moment, she pulled a knife from a sheath inside her boot and began to make incisions in the chest and abdomen, turning the internal organs around to review everything. Ryan and the others waited impatiently, watching her every move. After a few minutes, Mildred raised her head, smiling.
Clean! This one isn't a mutie.
Pushing his hat into a more comfortable position, JB smiled.
Hot damn, steak tonight.
Jack and Dean stayed at their posts, while Ryan and Christy joined Mildred at the dead animal. They produced knives and began dressing the stiffening carcass. Incisions were made, then the skin was peeled off, the fur carefully kept whole, and the meat wrapped in the skin with pieces of string used to tie the package closed. Ryan wiped his sticky hands on a rag from the Hummer's toolbox.
Time to leave. The gunshots and the smell of blood will both attract kinds of animals we don't want to deal with right now.
Mildred shouldered her medkit.
One additional problem? All of these were males. Not one bitch among the pack.
Passing off the rag, Ryan frowned.
Great. So this was just a hunting party, and the rest are out there somewhere.
Probably a whole lot more than 14. And when their mates don't come back, the females will come hunting.
All of a sudden, with a guttural cry, Doc spun, drawing his blaster. The rest of the companions copied the action and separated slightly. An automatic reaction learned the hard way from countless ambushes.
What is it, Doc?
The long barrel of Ryan's Steyr rested on the hood of the wag, giving him stability and cover. Christie's SMW-38 tracked the sky.
Somebody on the roof?
Doc didn't reply for a moment, but just stood there in the street, the Civil War blaster tightly held in both hands, while another tiny dust devil danced about his worn shoes. His face was scrunched, head tilted, as if concentrating on hearing something.
Could have sworn I heard a car engine. Mayhap I was mistaken.
Jack and Dean exchanged glances, but kept their weapons in a ready stance. Neither had heard a thing, certainly not a working engine. And the Deathlands winds were famous for playing tricks with sound.
An engine? Could be the sect man coming to check out the blaster noise.
Ryan looked over the group. They were ready to keep going, to negotiate with the sect man right here and now. But he knew they were as tired as he was. Too little food and too many jumps had weakened all of them. And tired people made mistakes, which got them chilled.
Let's go and find some place to cook dinner.
He climbed behind the wheel of the vehicle and started the engine.
We'll deal with the Baron tomorrow, after a full stomach and a good night's sleep.
Sounds good to me.
Christy took the passenger seat with a sigh. The others hesitated, but finally relented, the hunger in their bellies overcoming their impatience to deal with the tricksters from the Ville. Letting go of the rotting curtain, Harold stepped away from the second-floor window of the pre-dark hotel. This was where he rested before journeying across the desert to the secret armory of the old Baron. But there was no need to make the trip when those people across the street had everything he wanted. Blasters and a wag that still worked. That alone should buy Laura her freedom. Watching them drive off, Harold scrambled down the stairs to follow them, a plan already forming in his mind. He wanted to jump onto their wag from above, but the voices told him to follow the strangers and wait until after they had eaten. Food would make them sleepy. That was the time to strike.
Dinner will be ready soon.
Ryan turned over the steaks with a pair of tongs. The tantalizing smell was making everyone anxious in anticipation, but the meat wouldn't be served until thoroughly cooked, and there wasn't the slightest trace of pink on the inside. He was going to make damn sure there would be no case of poisoning from the wild animal. The interior of the pawn shop they were using as refuge was warm and well lit. There had been some camping lanterns, which still contained a quantity of kerosene, and gave them all the light needed. The windows were covered with layers of thick blankets from the upstairs apartments to keep the lights from giving away their location through the frosty windows. Ryan remembered the trader teaching him that while banks made good bolt holes with their stout walls and bulletproof windows, and high schools were excellent for long-term bases with their machine shops, pawn shops were the best. Stout iron bars covered the windows, and a flexible steel grating completely masked the front window. Even the back door was a solid slab of wood with 54-gauge sheet steel bolted over the whole thing, and they were often undisturbed, as most folks had no idea what the classic three brass balls of the store sign meant anymore. There were almost always piles of useful supplies inside. The shop consisted of one large room with a center island of heavy tables covered with speakers, stereos, air conditioners, television sets, and assorted electrical equipment. A brace of set cameras hung impotently from the ceiling, and a glass-topped counter ran around the walls. The left-side counter was covered with racks of musical instruments, while the right was jammed full of blasters, rifles, and shotguns of every type imaginable. Not an inch of wall space was unused. Inside the waist-high glass cases were rows of wallets, watches, cell phones, pagers, and a vast array of pistols. True, the ancient blasters were currently useless, the barrels and mechanisms clogged with clots of dried oil, but with a good cleaning there were enough blasters here to outfit an army. And a whole display case of hand blasters, also dead weight until disassembled and cleaned and oiled. A few were still in their sales boxes. Being unused, they were in a lot better condition than the rest. In the back vault, actually an old-fashioned standing safe resembling a cast-iron refrigerator, they had located trays of diamond rings and other pretty jewelry, deeds to cars and homes that no longer existed, and a lot of cordite ammo. Cordite lasted a lot longer than black powder or gunpowder. But after this many years, even the best deteriorated into a goop as explosive as dandruff. A bowling trophy case in the corner of the pawn shop had been easily converted into a rough kitchen, the trophies removed to hold any of the canned goods Mildred deemed edible from the apartment upstairs. Incredibly, there had even been a spice rack, and the Deathlands warrior knew from experience that even a century only made most spices tastier, which was just about the only good thing that ever came out of Skydark. Ryan flipped over the steaks again and dodged a fat spit of frying grease.
Mmm, smells ready.
It had been hours since their meager breakfast of cold beans, and even the raw wolf was starting to smell good. He remembered being hungrier than this, but not for a while.
Any time is good for me.
J.B. sat in a caneback chair, the Uzi in his lap. He was situated right next to the front door, keeping an ear on the street outside. The only sounds were the whispery desert winds and the occasional hoot of an owl. Repacking the instruments from the med kit in precise order for ease of use in an emergency, Mildred glanced up from her work.
Are you sure the Hummer is going to be okay in that garage next door? Without it, we have a long walk back to the redoubt.
Jack lifted the tiny item into view from a pocket.
Took ignition fuse, took spare gas. Law's an M60, here with us.
Besides, a wag's under a sheet of canvas inside a locked building with a booby trap on the door. That wag won't go nowhere.
Doc stood up from the stool he'd been sitting on. He was steadily stropping the blade of his sword stick with a whetstone. The polished steel shone like a mirror in the clear light of the lanterns.
Sir, it has been quite a while. Should I go spell Dean on the rooftop?
Moving the stakes about so they wouldn't stick to the grill, Ryan glanced at a loudly ticking wall clock. Once they had rewound the mainspring, the machine worked fine. Too bad it was much too big to bring along. And naturally, all of the watches in the display cases were battery-powered. Precision timepieces made out of gold and with jewel points, they were useless junk nowadays. He made a mental note to check and see if there was an antique store in the city.
Not for a while. 2-hour rotations.
He slid another piece of wood into the flames. The grease from the cooking meat dribbled off the grill, making the flames surge upward, spitting and crackling. It smelled wonderful.
Don't give him any special treatment just because he's young. He's old enough to carry his share of the load. He'll be fine.
As you say.
He had made the suggestion, and that was as far as he could broach the subject. He knew that the three things nobody should openly discuss were how to raise a child, how to make up with a lover, and how to go to hell. Finished with the packing, Mildred removed her stiff boots and started to massage her feet when some odd scratching and pop sounded. Across the shop, Christy stepped away from a weird moving machine. The cranking handle on the side spun steadily as the platter turned under the huge needle, and from the curving horn, a tenor started to faintly sing in another language. The physician's expression of puzzlement gave way to profound pleasure.
Good God! That's Enrico Caruso! I can't believe that old Victrola phonograph still works!
Built things to last in those days.
Doc proudly slid the sword into his cane with a snap.
Nothing electronic or computerized, just springs and honest steel.
JB crossed his feet at the ankles on top of a brass spittoon.
Nothing wrong with science. You just can't let it run the world, is all.
Glancing up from a VR helmet he was examining, Jack made an interesting comment.
Purpose of science to explain, not define.
Everybody turned to look at the teenager.
What? William Blake. Shee.
They always seemed surprised that he knew anything. Returning to their respective chores, the companions listened to the singer for a few minutes. When the music finished, Christy dutifully flipped over the record to the other side, but it was blank. Unfortunately, this was the only disc she could find. There didn't seem to be any jazz or swing in stock that she had heard before and enjoyed.
Il Pagliacci. It has been much too long since I last heard opera.
It's beautiful.
At the grill, Ryan arched an eyebrow, but kept his opinions to himself, sprinkling some crushed salt over the sizzling steaks. Vastly amused, Doc beamed a smile.
Incredible, madam. At last we agree on something.
Had to happen someday.
Cutting a notch in the thickest steak with his knife, Ryan checked the interior. Pinkish gray and getting darker.
Almost done. Better grab some plates.
It's a pleasure, sir.
Doc went to a cabinet. Smashing the stained glass door with the butt of his lama, the man gathered a stack of gilded plates from amid the china and crystal.
Need some help?
No, you stay right there.
Christy pushed some steamer trunks together to form a crude table for the repast. The stout brass and mahogany luggage would also give good protection to hide behind if they were attacked during dinner and had to fight. JB started to sit back down after his offer of help, when his senses picked up a faint noise coming from the roof. Then he remembered that Dean was still up there as lookout. On the roof of the pawn shop, Dean faintly smelled the wolf cooking and smacked his lips. It had been a while since they'd had meat, and he was really looking forward to dinner. Daydreaming about meals long gone, the boy watched as darkness descended quickly over the desert, the dying red light of the departing sun, climbing up the one great skyscraper in the ruined ville, going higher and higher until the building vanished completely. Softly, a sterile wind blew over the dead city, only the fragile barrier of white glass protecting the thousands of piles of dusty bones from being disturbed from their centuries-old slumber, slumped at their office desks or sprawled in their bedrooms. Just another ordinary day for them, frozen into a hellish tableau from a microsecond blast of supercharged neutrinos when cars and people alike died at the exact same instant. In the crumbling belfry of a church, an owl softly hooted for its mate. On the streets, lizards darted from one hiding place to another on an endless quest for insects to feast upon. In a city possessing a million lights, blackness reigned supreme. Leaning dangerously far over the edge of the rooftop, Dean rested his elbows on the cornice as the wind ruffled his hair. There was a park just off to the right, nothing much there except for dead trees and a dried-up lake with a marble statue of a mutie in the center. The woman was half Norm, half fish. Creepy, although he did like the way she wasn't wearing anything but a necklace and a smile. Not bad for a mutie. Then the boy spotted a sudden movement on the sandy streets below. Black specks moving fast and coming straight his way.
Huh, must be more wolves.
Digging in his pocket, he unearthed some spent shells. Dean carefully counted out three and put the rest back in his pants. There was no need to drop a handful. He was giving a warning to the folks below, but that was no reason to waste perfectly good brass. Reaching over to drop the warning shells, the gray moonlight unexpectedly disappeared, and darkness enveloped the boy. A terrible stench washed over him, smelling worse than rotting corpses. Dean choked on the fetid reek, almost retching. Backing away, he instinctively pulled out his Browning high power, and it was slammed from his grip by a powerful blow. He snatched for the flying weapon, but it disappeared into the night. Pistol gone, the gun in his pocket worse than useless at that range, The young Cotter decided that this was no place for heroics, turned, and sprinted for the tiny kiosk at the rear of the roof, the entrance to the stairwell. But something large landed between him and the exit as another stinking wave of hellish air washed over the boy, stealing the breath from his lungs. A ragged cough seized his throat, and yellow eyes opened wide in the blackness. Gasping for air, Dean recognized it as the winged mutie from the tunnel. Coughing and hacking, he cradled his aching hand and slowly retreated, trying to circle the beast, get on the other side of the kiosk, then scoot around fast and slam the door. But the winged beast, its great wings spread wide, countered every move, blocking any chance of escape, as if this were a game it played often. Dean knew that some animals played with their prey before killing, and he had a terrible feeling this was one of those breed. He tried to draw in air to call for help, and only choked on the awful stench again. It was sort of like skunk mixed with burning sewage, impossible to breathe. Flapping its huge wings, the mutie hissed loudly, exposing long yellow fangs, and Dean knew the game was over. It was going to attack. When a person had nothing to lose, attack and hope for the best, his father had always told him. Fumbling for the knife on his belt, Dean charged forward, slashing hopefully for the vulnerable throat below the inhuman eyes. The mutie easily dodged out of the way, as silent as a dream. Then, white-hot pain struck the boy's shoulder, and he found himself airborne. Breath exploded from Dean as he landed sprawling on a hard surface. Looking about, he saw he was on the roof of the next building over. His chest felt as if it were on fire, and he wondered if bones were broken. When clouds overhead parted for a brief instant, admitting a wealth of silvery light. Black wings extended, the mutie was flying straight toward him, and there on the rooftop by his boots was the dropped knife. Desperately, he dove for the weapon and collided headlong with the animal. Something snapped just over his head, and he kneed it as hard as he could in the belly. The mutie snarled in response and stepped back, its clawed feet accidentally kicking the knife farther away. Cursing his luck, Dean snarled back at the thing, hoping to frighten it, then ducked under a slashing wing that would have taken off his head. Blaster gone, knife lost, and he was still hacking for air, with no chance of a good scream for help. Matches. Didn't he have some matches in his pants? That would chase it away. Maybe rip off his shirt and set it on fire. But he needed a minute first to get some more room. Had to keep his distance. He didn't want to go hand to hand with the creature again, not with a broken arm and ribs. The pain was becoming a warm, fuzzy feeling, and the boy knew that shock was starting to set in. Not good. The mutie launched itself into the sky, and Dean dropped and rolled to the left, the rough concrete becoming smooth and sloping sharply upward beneath him, before he realized that he was now lying on the skylight he had spotted earlier. Delicately shifting his weight, Dean heard the glass musically crackle, and he forced himself to go limp to try to slide off. But one wrong move, and he would go through. He had to get off the skylight, find the knife, jab for the eyes, and wait for help to come. The others had to be only moments away. All he had to do was stall. Another warm stench flowed over the boy as the animal landed heavily on his chest, talons raking across his shirt and flesh. He cried out in pain, and the weakened glass shattered, sending the boy plummeting into the inky blackness beyond. His last coherent sight was of the broken skylight receding into the distance, the frosty panels of glass framing a black-winged figure, the cold yellow eyes watching him fall. Standing at the door, JB pressed his ear to the glass and tried to hear.
Tell ya, I heard something odd.
Dropped shells?
Ryan paused in his eating. If Dean had spotted somebody coming their way, the meal was over. The wolf was excellent, but not worth dying for. Hastily, he swallowed the last morsel without chewing.
Well, no. But definitely something metallic.
Jack lifted a corner of the blankets and peeked outside.
Maybe lizard or tin can.
Christy wiped her lips on some Irish linen.
Maybe not.
Ryan had heard enough. He rose and put aside the unfinished meal.
We better do a wreck.
The closest, Mildred leaned back in her office chair toward the barricaded door. She heard nothing.
Think the wolves followed us?
Possible.
JB placed a gran on the top of a steamer trunk. Laying down his Uzi, he deftly removed the black electrical tape holding the handle in place. A quick yank of the pin, and they were in business. Mildred looked at the dull green grin.
Great. How many more of these do we have?
The caller said it was HE, high explosives, with no shrapnel. Not a very good killing device, but enough of them could bring down an army.
One each.
JB reached into his munitions bag and passed them around.
The rest are hidden upstairs in case we had to fall back.
Sufficient unto the day.
Doc's hands were busy resetting the hammer on his Lama to fire the shotgun blast first.
These days, there is no such thing as overkill.
Jack tucked his gun into a pocket.
Best check wag, too.
At that moment, something thumped onto the sidewalk in front of the store. Everybody stopped eating as plates and drinks were cast aside and blasters were grabbed. Ryan cradled his Sig Sauer in his hand as he went to the door.
That wasn't some empty brass shells. Too heavy and solid.
Christy nodded, peeking outside through the blankets covering the display window.
Gaia, there's a blaster lying on the ground.
Running high power?
Looks like.
JB frowned, unfolding the wire stock of the Uzi.
No way Dean dropped his blaster.
Well, somebody did.
Ryan eased off the chain and darted into the night. With his blaster sweeping for targets, he let his eye adjust to the darkness and glanced around. Christy joined him on the sidewalk, with the rest staying inside and covering them from the doorway. Ryan jerked his head to the left. She nodded, and he went to the right, but only got a few feet. There on the broken concrete was a familiar metallic shape. Rushing over, he scooped up the weapon. It was a .38 caliber Browning high power in near mint condition. The odds of somebody else having one of these were astronomical.
It's Dean's all right.
Ryan looked at the roof. Nothing was visible.
Shit. Any blood?
None that I could see.
Placing two fingers in his mouth, he whistled sharply twice and waited. No reply.
We got trouble.
They hurried back inside, and Ryan closed the door, keeping one hand on the busted lock while working the bolt with the other.
Okay, something is wrong. Dean might have dropped the blaster, but no way is he also asleep on guard duty. Christy and I'll hit the rooftop. Mildred, JB are the anchor here. Doc and Jack wreck the ground, then join us topside.
Everybody moved without discussion. Grabbing a canteen, Mildred poured water over the grill to kill the coals and went behind the steamer trunks. They would give decent protection and offered acceptable vantage of the front window and the door to the stairs.
We'll fire around if there's trouble.
JB called to him from the doorway, but Ryan was already charging up the stairs. It took them only seconds to reach the top of the building. Ryan and Christy burst out of the stairwell, blasters in hand. But the roof was empty. Only a warm wind from the desert blowing steadily over the bare concrete. Frowning, Ryan gave a pigeon coo and listened for an answer, while Christy moved to a prominent dark spot on the white concrete. She didn't have to touch it to know it was fresh blood. The redhead eased back the hammer on her revolver and whistled sharply three times. Scowling, Ryan gave an answering coo, and they moved out in a crisscross pattern, blasters searching for targets. A minute later, they met at the far corner.
Anything?
Nothing. Think he fell off?
The woman looked at the 3-foot-high wall edging the roof and thought of the 5-foot-tall boy.
I don't think so. You better go tell the others. I'll stay here and keep a watch.
Check.
As Ryan sprinted for the door, darkness enveloped them, something large blocking the weak moonlight shining through the dense clouds overhead.
It's the Muni!
Ryan Steyer belched flame and thunder at the menacing creature. A few yards away, Christy was briefly illuminated by the muzzle flash of her booming hand blaster. Under the double assault, the shadowy figure was hurled backward and over the edge of the roof to disappear.
Fire blast! Creature did the same thing back at the tunnel!
Christy agreed, thumbing fresh shells into her own blaster. A snarl sounded from the sky above them, and a dimly seen shape flashed by their left side, then the right. But the man and woman held their fire, waiting for a clear shot. Did the animal understand blasters could be emptied? Just how smart was this thing?
I'm impressed. It's circling, trying to confuse us into thinking there's more than one. Must be smarter than it looks.
Then something juicy smacked onto the metal door of the raised stairwell, and they both heard a steady sizzling sound as the door started to dissolve away.
Blood of the mother! What the hell was that? Acid rain?
triggering another round. She kept moving to make herself more difficult to hit when more blaster shots split the night as the rest of the companions poured out of the doorway. She bent out of the way of a raking claw.
Watch out! Deming spits poison!
Standing brazen before the mutie, Doc and Jack now realized why the woman had been bobbing about and quickly followed her example of shoot and dodge. Bleeding from a score of minor wounds, the frustrated beast spread its wings and took to the air, diving toward Ryan. Leveling his blaster, he stood there until the very last moment, then triggered the Stire, the muzzle flame reaching out to touch the beast. There was an audible crack of cartilage, and the creature hit the rooftop, roaring with pain. The left wing flew impotently while yellow blood poured from the ghastly wound. Angering about to avoid hitting Jack, Doc waited for a clear shot and placed each slug from the Lama with extreme care, each impact making the mutie reel crazily. The percussion pistol took minutes to reload and prime. These 9 shots were all he had before reduced to his sword stick, and he highly doubted the lethal efficiency of a steel blade against a mutie the size of a gorilla. As Ryan moved in for the kill, the thing spat loudly. Jack tackled Ryan from the side, and they hit the roof as fluid smacked onto the ventilation fan. The sizzling noise of the acid eating the metal sounded like bacon frying in the darkness. Ryan grunted his thanks. They stood and fired both weapons, going for the throat and groin. Christy and Doc joined them, forming a ragged line, and volley fired at the darting beast. Unable to escape into the air, it spat again and again as the barrage of blaster fire hammered steadily. But its motions were becoming slower as the beast weakened, the useless wing dragging on the roof, slowing it considerably. Slashing out with its good wing, its talons narrowly missed Christy. She stood her ground and fired, blowing out an eye. Now the beast screamed insanely and charged. They broke before the rush, holding away on both sides, then stepping in again. The animal was trapped in a killing box, with every blaster firing from all sides. A knee buckled, it spat randomly, an arm drooped limply, blood pooled around its clawed feet. It slashed out a clawed wing, and that one drooped as the cartilage was smashed. Pain, overwhelming sense, it continued to rush the humans, but the deadly blasters never ceased, one person reloading while the one alongside kept firing, until finally, the broken, bloody thing collapsed, pale yellow blood pooling around the riddled corpse. Ryan stepped close and cut off its head with his panga. Then slid his rifle barrel underneath and flipped over the mutie. Jack rubbed a painful spot on his hand, where a tiny drop of the poison had splattered on his bare flesh.
Ah, bastard tough mutie.
It looks like a bat. A night feeder.
That's no mutie. See that golden blood? Means it's from a pre-dark lab.
Another biological weapon.
Doc plunged out the charging holes of his Lama. The chore was normally done sitting at a flat table. He fumbled with the placement of a copper-coated percussion nipple.
Damn them all to hell!
Good thing I heard that warning Dean gave. If that thing had caught us inside with no room to maneuver, we'd be in its belly by now.
Where, Dean?
Piss-colored blood and spent shells were splashed about, but there was no sign of the boy.
Don't know. He wasn't here when we arrived.
Dean! Dean!
Only the wind whispered in reply.
Well, he has to be around here somewhere.
Maybe he's hiding, or fell over the edge.
Any sign of him on the ground?
The replies of the others sounded strange to him, as if someone else had asked if the boy were dead, instead of him. He felt oddly distant from the conversation, as if he were speaking to them from over a great length of pipe. Doc forced a neutral expression as he holstered his blaster and buttoned down the flap.
Not a sign of him, but don't worry. It is only 3 stories onto soft sand. If the lad did tumble, he probably has no worse than a broken leg.
Jumped another building?
Could have. I'll check the roof to our west.
A sharp whistle cut the night. Then J.B. waved from the east side.
Here! Over here!
The companions rushed to the edge of the roof. The armorer pointed across the alleyway to the next building. The acid rain-pitted expanse of concrete was empty, except for a skylight. But one of the milky white glass panels in the framework was broken, and lying nearby in a splash of red blood was Dean's knife. Tossing Christy the rifle, Ryan backed away a few steps and charged. At the last moment, he jumped over the low wall and sailed across the gulf of the alleyway to to land heavily on the concrete roof of the next building. He went to one knee, but was up again in an instant. Going to the hole in the skylight, Ryan listened for any sounds before cupping his hands and shouting the boy's name.
Dean!
There was no answer.
Mildred!
The physician reached into her medkit and tossed him a small object. Ryan made the catch one-handed and squeezed the charging handle on the tiny flashlight a few times to power the miniature battery inside. It was old and weak, but 100 times better than a candle. Playing the beam through the hole, he saw an open area directly under the skylight with a balcony on four sides. A staggered staircase of iron lace spiraled down into the building and out of range of the weak beam. He stuffed the flashlight into his belt.
I'm going in. Meet you on the ground floor.
Christy headed for the kiosk.
On our way.
Carefully testing the skylight for strength, Ryan knew it would never hold his 200-plus pounds. Carefully wiggling the rest of the glass shards from the frame, he tossed them aside. Then, grabbing the part of the framework directly attached to the concrete roof, he carefully lowered himself down. The angle was awkward, but he held on tight. Lowering himself as far as he could, Ryan swung his legs back and forth until he had sufficient momentum and let go. Pain racked his back as he scraped over the railing, and he landed sprawled on the soft carpeting of the topmost balcony. Scrambling erect, Ryan pulled out his blaster and flashlight. Anything could be inside this place. Just because the roof was untouched didn't mean the front door wasn't wide open. He couldn't chance being caught unprepared. Playing the beam around, he saw that the central area was squared off by the fancy iron lace railings. An open framework elevator shaft of the same material stood nearby. Moving along the floor, he noted the array of closed doors with tarnished nameplates lining the balcony. Every one was closed, with no signs of busted wood on the jamb showing a forced entry. Lush plastic plants and oak stands adorned the corners, and a squat copier stood reverently in an alcove near a brace of soda machines.
Dean! Son! Can you hear me?
Dead silence. Ryan shook his worries from his mind. Negative thoughts would only slow his reflexes. He had to concentrate on finding his son. Still holding the Sig Sauer, Ryan placed two fingers in his mouth and whistled once loudly. No response. With a growing sense of unease in the pit of his stomach, the man moved past the elevator and started down the open stairs, shining the flashlight everywhere. At the third story, he encountered an iron grating padlocked shut. Ryan hesitated for a moment, then leveled the 9mm blaster and shot off the lock. The cough of the silenced weapon was lost in the crash of the exploding metal that seemed to endlessly bounce off the plaster walls, the noise somehow making the building seem even emptier than before. Two more grates blocked his progress, and by the time he reached the ground floor, the rest of the companions were already waiting in the spacious lobby. The area was well lit by the strong light of the lanterns. Wide couches surrounded low tables piled with magazines, the pale walls decorated with ornate paintings of landscapes and running water. Velvet ropes formed a maze to traverse before reaching the massive reception desk, where a tiny sign sternly announced that no smoking was allowed. JB held his Uzi in a steady combat grip.
We heard shots!
Ryan clicked off the flashlight and returned it to Mildred.
Locked doors. Any sign of Dean outside?
Not a trace.
Shoving aside the soft ropes, Christy strode behind the reception desk and glanced underneath for Dean, while Doc burst out of the ladies' room, his frock coat spreading wide in his wake, like the wings of some terrible prehistoric bird.
Lavatories are clear.
Mildred yanked open an unmarked door and jumped back, almost firing as a collection of brooms and mops piled out, nearly hitting her.
Janitor's closet also empty.
Ryan cupped his hands.
Dean!
The name echoed throughout the old building. A great rage was building within the man, the fury tempered with the dire possibility the boy was dead and gone. Crossing the lobby past a brace of telephone cubicles, Ryan kicked open the first door. Inside were only chairs, desks dotted with coffee cups, and a huge easel covered with a meaningless pie chart, showing the excellent performance of something, somewhere.
Okay, we do this systematically. I'll take the left side with Christy. Jack with Mildred. JB, stay here and cover us with the Uzi. Doc, sweep outside again.
Scratching her cheek with the barrel of her .38, Christy spoke.
Remember, the Mutey can fly. If it wasn't alone and another grabbed...
Then there's nothing to be done. We can't track an animal in flight. So concentrate on what can be done. Search this place room by room.
Over here!
Jack was partially masked by the shadows of the reception desk. Grabbing a lantern, Ryan shone the light in the direction of the call. The pale teenager was kneeling at the iron lace railing that cordoned off the middle of the lobby.
Central access not stop here. Down another level.
In a second, Ryan was already alongside the teen, leaning over the railing and shining the lantern around. A chrome and steel kinetic sculpture made of sharp panes and angles rose from the dusty center of a dried fountain. Dozens of small tables dotted the floor around it, and lying amid them was a crumpled human body, limbs splayed, a trickle of blood dribbling from his slack mouth. Dean.
How do we get down there? The enclosed stairs stop on this level. Where are the ones leading to the basement?
Doc gestured with the Lama.
This way.
Staying at the railing, Ryan gauged the distance and then jumped over the banister. He landed next to the boy, missing the granite rim of the fountain's basin by only inches. The others arrived minutes later, charging out of the enclosed stairwell. They maneuvered through the rows of tables and found Ryan kneeling solemnly alongside his son. He held the boy's small wrist in his hand.
There's no pulse.
Pushing the man aside, Mildred expertly placed two fingers on the right side of the lad's throat, just under the mastoid bone.
I can feel a pulse.
She rested a palm on his forehead.
But it's weak and fast, and the skin is clammy.
Already her tone was shifting from concerned to pragmatic. Never think about the person you are treating. Concentrate on fixing the injuries. Later on, there will be time for celebration. Or mourning. Ryan frowned, having seen enough in his life to recognize Dean's symptoms.
He's in shock. Gotta keep him warm. Christy?
On it.
Placing the Stire on a table, she shucked the bearskin coat and passed it over. Mildred tucked the fur over the boy.
Done here. Jack, cover me.
The young man followed her into the darkness, and soon there came sounds of smashing wood and ripping cloth. While Mildred took care of his son, Ryan glanced around and saw they were in the center of a food court. Rows of garish plastic signs proclaiming delicious snacks, long decayed into dust. Rows of plastic tables encircled the fountain with the weird metallic sculpture. On the other side of the court was the iron lace framework of the elevator, adjacent to more public restrooms, phones, and drinking fountains. Rising, Ryan removed his palm from the floor and flexed his hand.
Bastard tile flooring is ice cold. We've got to get him off this.
He started to slide his arms under the boy, but Mildred pushed the man away.
Don't touch him until I say so.
Then she ripped open the boy's shirt. His hairless chest was smeared with blood and heavily scarred in spots, but there were no cuts or slashes readily apparent. But his forearm was thick with partially dried blood. She probed the tender flesh.
Clawed. Some minor discoloration, but no signs of toxic striation.
The Mutey is poisonous?
Apparently so, but none got in the wounds. However, that isn't what I'm worried about.
Suddenly shuddering, Dean began to have trouble breathing. Ryan started for him and stopped. As careful as if she were handling antique glass, Mildred took the boy's head and tilted it backward an inch, the raspy noise easing somewhat.
Tissue damage to his throat. Just a bruise, really, but it can swell and close off his breathing. I better prep for a trach just in case it gets worse.
Whipping out a knife, she placed a small piece of soft plastic tubing from a fish aquarium alongside her switchblade knife and a packet of cotton wadding. The med kit held the big instruments, but Mildred always carried small medical items in her pockets, just for a case like this. Then she cursed,
shit,
bumping her head against the rounded corner of one of the plastic tables.
For God's sake, give me some room to work, and more light!
With his back to the wall between two fast food counters, J.B. stood guard while Ryan and Doc started to remove the obstructions. The tables were bolted to the floor, but that didn't hinder the men from clearing a space around the patient and doctor. As Doc tipped the plastic tables sideways, Ryan set the lanterns close to the shiny plastic tops to reflect the light and amplify the meager illumination. As bright as it was, there was no overhead illumination, and for one fleeting instant, Ryan felt he would have given his remaining eye for a single working light bulb. Concentrating on her task, Mildred carefully probed behind the boy's ears for any telltale swelling, then checked his nose for a trace of clear fluid.
No sign of a skull fracture. That's good news.
Furiously pumping the handle of her flashlight, Charging the battery to maximum, she gently used a thumb to peel back an eyelid, shining the beam directly into Dean's eyes. The pupils dilated very slowly.
Damn.
Shifting position, the physician started to unlace the boot on Dean's right leg, her dark fingers lost in the shadows. Christy and Jack arrived just then with their arms full of draperies. The redhead deposited her bundle near the boy.
No blankets, but these are good and thick.
Jack dropped his load of curtains and valances on top of the pile.
Need more? We'll get carpet.
Mildred eased off the boy's army boot.
Oh, that's good enough for now.
Drawing a knife, she slid the pommel of the weapon upward along the inner sole of his bare foot. Then she did it again, watching his unresponsive toes. Doc sat on the edge of the fountain, watching the process with growing unease. He remembered a farming accident from his youth in Vermont, and how the local country doctor had done the same thing, and what the awful verdict was.
What's wrong?
Sliding the sock back on the limp foot, Mildred looked at Ryan directly.
Your son has a concussion. No way to tell how bad. Thankfully, there doesn't seem to be any loose bone fragments. Might be okay if there's no internal clotting. A couple of ribs, his right hand and left leg are broken, but no compound fractures, thank God. Right arm is dislocated. Painful as hell, but not serious. Probably landed sideways, breaking his leg, which slowed his momentum enough to stop the impact from smashing his skull open.
Mildred knew she was sounding callous, and her old teachers at medical school would have had a fit about her talking to a patient's parent this way. But those days were long gone. Ryan needed information, hard and fast. There was simply no time for courtesy. Ryan gave no outward sign of concern at the news.
Partially bit through his tongue. I can fix that with a needle and thread, good as new. And I have two antibiotic tablets I've been saving for an emergency.
Use them!
I had already planned on doing so. However, it's his back that worries me. I'm not getting any autonomic reflexes. It may only be a temporary condition, or there could be significant damage to his spinal cord.
Oh, hell. A broken back?
Is he in pain?
No, but...
Then, much as she hated to, Mildred told him the truth.
But he might be crippled, or blind, or completely paralyzed for the rest of his life. Spinal injuries can go a lot of ways, most of them bad.
Ryan's face underwent a series of somber expressions in a heartbeat. Blind. Paralyzed. Unable to fight or run, his son would be as good as dead. Worse, he would endanger the rest of them. His hand instinctively brushed against the stock of his 9mm pistol, but then jerked away as if struck by an electric spark. Guilt flooded his being for even the thought. Tilting her head, Mildred noticed the quick movements, and brushed a coil of beaded hair out of her face.
Don't even think about such things yet. There's still a lot we can do first.
Name it. Anything.
Well, first and foremost, we immobilize the boy completely. He can't be allowed to move an inch in any direction. God, what I'd give for a paramedic air pack.
She shook away those thoughts.
We need wood for splints, and rope, or better yet, something flat like a belt to hold him down, and a flat board to get him off this cold floor.
Blanket's no good?
Can't cushion his back. It has to be hard.
Ryan took a lantern from the floor.
Let's move.
In orderly fashion, the rest of the companions separated throughout the food court, the flames of their lanterns bobbing behind counters and disappearing into back rooms. JB got Mildred alone for a bit, and confronted the physician.
What are you not telling him?
Mildred glanced sideways at the man, the light reflecting off his wire-rimmed spectacles.
A four-story fall onto polished tile, JB. What do you think I haven't told him yet?
In only a few minutes, Ryan and the others returned with a collection of paneling, a door with hinges still attached, chair arms, shelves, and numerous belts.
Packing strips from the mail room. A most fortuitous acquisition.
Mildred agreed, examining a woven cloth strip.
Damn near perfect. Good work. Jack, start cutting the buttons off those coats.
The teen nodded as a slim knife appeared in his pale hand, and he started to slice.
Christy, lay that door right there. Anybody find boards for splints?
Bookcase shelving.
Ryan set the wood nearby.
From the security office. Way too wide, but we can split them lengthwise.
Excellent.
Jack handed over the garment he had been working on.
Here.
Laying the coat across the door, Mildred rolled some miscellaneous fabric into a tube and laid it sideways at the low end of the door. Then another, smaller roll near the top.
Okay, listen up, people. First thing, follow my lead and move on my command not one second earlier. We have to do this in unison, or we may kill him right here and now. Understand?
Ryan started to say something, but held his tongue.
Okay, everybody gather round. I want everyone except Doc to take hold of the loose clothing on a limb. I'll hold his head. Don't touch his body. Just move the clothing and try to shift him as little as possible. That's vitally important.
Well, the others did as directed. Doc positioned himself at the door. Good thing they had removed the knob so it lay flat on the floor. The physician's hands cupped the boy's head, fingertips resting under his jawline.
Now be careful. We're only lifting Dean an inch. Soon as he's off the floor, Doc slides the door underneath. Keep those supports in position at his knees and neck. Got that?
Understood.
Mildred watched their intent faces.
On my call, we go on the word mark. Not a second before. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Mark!
The companions lifted in unison, and Dean moaned as he cleared the floor, his clothing tearing a little from the strain.
Now, Doc, slide the door.
The loose hinge scraped noisily as Doc placed it under Dean's hovering body.
In position.
Good. We go down on 3. 1, 2, 3.
The companions lowered Dean onto the makeshift platform and stepped away. Releasing his head from her grasp, Mildred quickly inspected the boy again.
It's okay for now.
Ryan felt the cold rush of adrenaline as if he were in combat.
Now what?
Get my new medical kit. I don't need the instruments yet, but it's best to have them close just in case. And when you get the chance, thank the Lord that I have something to work with.
Jack rose and headed for the enclosed stairs.
My turn, look out.
Doc, go with him as cover. There might be more of those wing things running around outside.
Sir, consider me Perseus of Greece.
Doc followed the teenager out of the circle of light.
Mildred, anything else?
Christy knew that death was just part of the wheel of life, but this was the son of her lover, a child she loved very much. Sometimes the wheel of life needed a good solid kick in the ass. Opening her canteen, the physician sat in one of the plastic chairs built into the tables and took a swallow.
Yes. We better start moving our supplies over here, especially that brazier, and find something to use as a bedpan. We're going to be here for a while.
That's not a good idea.
Ryan sat on the rim of the fountain, the kinetic sculpture behind, glittering like a Christmas tree from the light of the lanterns.
Once you've bandaged his breaks, we can carry him to the redoubt. There's a full medical hospital on level 5. Everything you'll need.
Yeah, sorry, Millie, but we can't stay here. Whatever was out there might come back, with friends.
Mildred gestured tiredly.
Then shoot him in the head. We take Dean on the road, and it's the same thing. At least chilled by a friend is faster.
A minute of silence passed. Ryan gave her a pained glance.
Absolutely certain?
Hell no! Until he wakes up, there's nothing I know for sure. Except that he's damn lucky to still be alive.
Ryan looked at his son. Dean laid on the ground, shivering and trembling, his complexion a deathly white. Ryan eyed the impossible stairwell.
Maybe we could all lift in unison like before.
One more jostle and he could die. We had to do it the first time, but never again. He's not going anywhere. Not down the hall, not across the hall, nowhere.
She pointed at the boy.
That's why a jacket is under his leg to keep it from shifting position.
Sitting upright, Ryan chewed over this unwelcome information.
For how long?
Couple of days, at least. Maybe a week. I can't tell until he stabilizes and I can chance trying some tests.
Trapped here for a week. Possibly with more of those wing things roaming the streets. Not to mention the wolves and the sec men from the Ville.
The sec men might be able to help, but probably not. Always best to plan for the worst. It comes true more often than not.
So we dig in for the duration. Should be safe enough once we seal this building.
He looked at the ceiling.
Okay. We definitely have got to do something about the skylight. Maybe we could replace the glass so it isn't obvious where the accident happened.
This place will never be a hard sight. Front door is a joke, and there must be 100 windows to this place. It's a friggin' glass box.
We can nail boards across the inside of the office windows and jam the hallway door shut. That'll give any attacker two things to get through. However, this bastard central air shaft is begging for attack.
Maybe we could lace barbed wire across the railings. That would give us a good 3 levels of protection. Nothing is going to fly through that. Probably find some in the local hardware store. Nails, too.
Sounds good. But first, we wreck the whole building to make sure that we are alone here.
Ryan put a hand on his blaster.
Then we go get the big conference table from the first floor, set it over Dean to hide him from sight, and protect from any more falling glass.
That will do for a start. And then dump furniture into the elevator shaft until it's jammed solid. That's an express route down here.
And to Dean. A chilling thought.
Which leaves the stairs as the only way in or out. What the hell? We can't retreat anyway.
A crash made everybody draw weapons as the door to the stairwell burst open and running figures emerged. Postures relaxed only when the companions recognized Jack and Doc. However, the two men bore serious expressions.
Gone! Medkit gone!
Along with the Hummer, the M60, and a lot of rifles off the wall.
We've been jacked? That engine I heard earlier was our own wag?
Indeed, sir. Curse the Visigoths!
Shitfire, we were only here a few minutes.
Mildred checked her wristchron.
No, Christy. It's been well over an hour.
More than long enough.
But the rockets are still in the pawn shop. They took the useless pre-dark blasters and left the laws. That I do not understand.
Illiterate, probably. Couldn't read the boxes.
Any tracks?
Doc rested on his cane.
Impossible to see in the night. Even if the moon were full, the sky is solid with clouds.
And storm coming. Big one.
Irritably, JB pushed back his fedora.
Swell. That'll erase any tire tracks we could trace.
Then we'll find the bastard tonight.
Retrieving the Steyr, Ryan checked the clip. Taking out the half-full clip, the man slammed a new clip into the loading recess and worked the bolt, chambering around.
Doc, stay here with Mildred and Dean.
The physician stood and looked at Ryan.
If I have to operate, we'll need that kit badly. However, this could be a trap to lure us outside.
Ryan started for the stairs.
Sure as hell hope so, because that would mean they're still nearby.
Outside, the streets were as dark as pitch, the sky a swirling, mottled mixture of greens and reddish-orange. The only faint light came from the twin searchlights, steadily sweeping the clouds in an endless pattern. Spreading out in a standard defensive pattern, the companions moved down the block and into the alleyway. The canvas sheet lay crumpled in a corner near an overturned garbage bin. Dropping to one knee, Ryan studied the sandy street, brushing the surface lightly with his hand.
Nothing here. Can't tell if this was one person or 10.
One. Used branches to erase his tracks getting here.
So we can't backtrack him. Frigging pro.
Yep.
Perimeter sweep. 5 blocks in every direction. Then another 5 until we find his tracks.
And there's no need to bring him back alive if you find the medkit.
That was the plan.
JB switched the fire selector on the Uzi from single shot to full auto.
He's going down, my friend.
A shape swooping down from overhead interrupted any further instructions, and the companions raised their weapons, staring into the darkness. Ryan whistled twice, and they followed him into the gutted paint store next door to the garage. Christy crouched behind a stack of cans.
Another one of those damn muties.
Adjusting his glasses, JB scrunched his face.
Hate to say it, but maybe we'll have to wait until morning. In the dark, this thing could ace us one by one.
Jack's arms rested on the front counter. Blaster pointed steadily at the smashed window.
Set fire to place. Not like light.
The shadow of something flew past the store as Ryan considered the idea.
No, can't risk the flame spreading across the street.
As if forcing his hands through mud, Ryan lowered his blaster. Dean couldn't be moved, and the muties ruled the night. They had no choice.
Let's get back inside.
At the moment, logic, not fists, would save his son.
We have to wait until morning.
As they returned to the food court of the building, Mildred saw their faces and knew what the situation was.
Is there another medkit in the redoubt?
Does it matter? Without the Hummer, it's a 2-3-day walk.
He waved that aside.
The wag was almost out of fuel, and we have the spare can. We might find it only a couple of blocks away, dead in the street.
Well, there isn't another medkit. There is an X-ray machine, and I could really use a view of his skull and spine.
But it's not portable. And even if there were a portable X-ray machine, the isotopes would have decayed into lead by now. The thulium core only has a 5-year half-life.
Tenderly, Ryan brushed the hair off the boy's forehead. The skin was clammy to his touch. Privately, he cursed himself for a fool. He should have known there had to be a reason why a town full of treasure hadn't been looted. Then he suddenly realized where his train of thought was leading. That could be an answer to their problem.
These ruins are in excellent shape. There has to be a hospital somewhere, or a doctor's office. Might find what we need locally.
Worth a look. You never know, eh?
But right now we wreck this dump and start ferrying over the supplies.
Ryan shouldered his long blaster.
We'll eat and sleep in shifts until dawn. Then we do a scout of the neighborhood. After that, we split into teams. JB and Doc will hunt for supplies. I'll track the thief.
Plus, we better get to work on the defenses.
Christie shivered slightly from the chill in the basement.
We'll need them if those muties come in a flock.
Mildred dampened a rag with the canteen and wiped down the boy's forehead.
Can't be many more around. They're too big. They'd eat all of the wolves and lizards and then start on each other. So unless they're smart enough to open cans, logic dictates there are only a couple at most.
Sure as hell hope you're right.
Ryan glanced at his son, and then upward at the broken skylight 4 stories away.
Because it took the lot of us to barely chill one of these bastard things. And we have no hope in hell of stopping a swarm.
Crackling torches dotted the streets of the ville in reddish light, the illumination reflecting off the honeycombed glass of the many greenhouses. The streets were deserted, with every door closed, every window bolted shut, only the murmur of soft voices coming from inside the lower levels of the intact buildings and from underneath the gutted ruins. Beyond the pile of smashed vehicles composing the Great Wall, Sekhmen watched the sky with blasters in hand as the beams of the searchlights swept the cloudy sky, endlessly searching for an enemy that would attack without notice. In the far distance, a wolf howled in agony for a lost mate. Cursing under their breaths, grim Sekhmen moved closer to the lights and made sure their weapons were ready for combat. Cutting through the alleyway between the marketplace and a partly built greenhouse, Leonard Strickland strode purposefully across the dark plaza, heading toward the bright lanterns of his father's palace. After the revolution, the open area before the converted museum had been painstakingly cleared of structures so that the defenders inside would have a clear field of fire against any attackers. Leonard considered that a practical idea. If the previous baron had thought of such things, indeed, if the despot had considered anything other than harshly disciplining his people, then the man might still be in charge of Alphaville instead of a chained prisoner in the dank basement of his former home. The walls of the pre-dark museum soared 20 yards into the sky, a louvered expanse of granite strips interlocking into a solid, homogeneous whole of amazing strength. No windows marred the 3 sides of the pre-dark structure. The entire front had once been a window, but the new baron had bricked up the vulnerable area, both inside and out, giving it a relative stability almost equal to the granite sides. On the roof, Sekhmen steadily patrolled the perimeter of the building, bolt-action long blasters held at quarter arms. Secretly, Leonard knew there were also small kegs of black powder with homemade fuses in a locked munitions box up there to drop on invaders. Any attacking force would be met with fierce opposition. Born and bred on the dirty streets of Alphaville, Baron Gunther Strickland didn't make the same mistakes as his dethroned predecessor. On the ground, sandbags formed a low wall before the double doors, the emblazoned brass marred with dull streaks where soft lead bullets had ricocheted. A half-circle of steel I-beams, salvaged from the ruins across the Stink River Chasm, had been welded into tripods to act as a deterrent to attacking WAGs or even APCs. Getting past those would take a pre-dark tank. Coils of barbed wire stretched across the ground like dark smoke frozen in time and space. A few strips of stained cloth here and there marked the spots where Sekhmen had thrown the corpses of their fallen comrades onto the wire so they could gain access to the museum and continue the fight to usurp their former leader. Before being captured alive, Baron Mad Jim Harvin had unleashed his pet winged muties, but it didn't work. Then Sergeant Gunther Strickland had carefully orchestrated the revolt at first dawn so his troops would be safe from the deadly black bats, or flying lizards, or whatever the hell the muties were. Leonard had no idea, nor did anybody else, as the creatures only appeared at night, and the only folks who got a good view of them died soon afterward, torn to shreds. Not a single one of the creatures had ever been successfully slain. Leonard walked toward the front doors of the palace so that the guards would see him coming. Five huge men stood behind the sandbags, long blasters over their shoulders, hand blasters at their belts. The elite, the Baron called them. The five were sworn to die before allowing invaders inside the home of their Baron. To the left and right of them rested a pair of old muzzle-loading cannons. It had taken 2 years to unblock the barrels, but the weapons were fully functional now, and the soft cotton bags stacked in the red plastic milk crates were filled with bits of broken glass, bent nails, and other tiny scraps of metal. A band of raiders had gotten this far once, and after the cannons roared, nothing remained but bloody clothing and smashed bones. It was the last direct attack.
Morning, Lieutenant.
Morning, Sergeant.
Leonard smiled, trying not to lose his armload of papers.
Permission to enter, please.
Granted, sir, as always.
The guard pulled the door open and saluted as Leonard walked through. Inside was the mate of the outside cannons and two more sec men, a sergeant and a private, standing behind more sandbags. They put aside their card game and snapped to attention.
Morning, sir. Dropping off a message or looking for your father?
The phrase embarrassed the adopted boy.
The second, Sergeant. Do you know where the Baron is?
Cellar. We caught a thief last week. Now he's getting justice.
One of our own, or a newcomer?
Local man. Cobbler. Been here for years.
Did he lie about the crime?
Petty infractions, such as stealing food, were a pardonable crime, and the perpetrator often got no more than a dozen lashes. But lying to the Baron was death by the machine. The private shook his head.
He should have known better.
Thank you.
The boy hurried off, still clutching the portfolio of papers and maps to his chest. The private sighed, reclaiming his chair and gathering his cards.
I hope that kid toughens up. Don't want a mama's boy like Leo there as our Baron.
Fanning the cards in his hand, the sergeant shifted them, about to hide the straight he had drawn.
Don't be fooled. The boy's still young, but I saw him in the revolt when we charged this place. He took an arrow in the leg and a bullet in the chest, and he fought on with his father. Tough as a slut's heart, the both of them.
Long as he ain't twisted like his old man.
The private laid down a card and drew a fresh one.
I hate all that screaming in the night.
Well, gotta be worse for them doing the screaming.
I suppose it is.
He brushed a hand through his golden crew cut.
Damn, I'm sure glad my girl is a blonde.
Smoking slightly, vegetable oil lanterns with rope wicks stood in wall niches, illuminating the interior. The high vaulted ceiling of the museum was perfect for conducting away the greasy fumes. Hurrying across the terrazzo expanse of the front hall, Leonard turned left and took the main stairs downward, the broad steps some 4 yards wide. There used to be a brass handrail along the center, but that had been destroyed when the rebels drove an APC down the stairs, chasing the former Baron. Guards and maids greeted Leonard politely as he hurried along the corridor past the storage room and the armory, past the furnace room, and finally the jail. The door was closed, tufts of cloth rimming the jamb of the thick portal, but he could still hear the muted roar of machinery inside and a man pitifully screaming. Withdrawing a small ring of keys from his pocket, Leonard unlocked the door and entered the deafening charnel house, the air stinking of excrement and exhaust fumes. A man, hanging from the ceiling by chains, was screaming.
Mercy!
The chains were wrapped about the hanging man's wrists, a trickle of blood flowing down his arms as he struggled to get free.
Please!
The words were barely audible over the muted rumble of the machine directly beneath. A black plume of smoke streamed from its exhaust pipe, and the ceiling was blacker than hell itself from the accumulation of grime from its use. Squads of somber men in clean uniforms stood about the abattoir, watching the suspended victims struggle for life. None of the grim faces were softened by an expression of pity or even interest. Baron Gunther Strickland crossed his powerful arms across his barrel chest.
Mercy? Mercy? An interesting choice of words for a traitor.
The red-headed giant towered over the other men, his long, fiery red hair moving as if endowed with a will of its own. The prisoner howled as the chain jerked, and once more he was lowered inexorably toward the maw of the churning machine.
I am innocent!
Between his bare feet, he could see the blur of the interlocking blades whirling at incredible speed. His stomach heaved at the idea of what was happening, but nothing rose into his throat. He hadn't been fed for days, in exact preparation for such an eventuality.
I didn't break the window!
Gunther accepted a silver chalice of cool wine from a buddy maid in army fatigues.
No, but your son did, and valuable plants were destroyed. Should we punish him instead?
Yes. Yes.
Rivulets of sweat poured off the man's naked body. His toes could feel the vibrations of the machine in the air. It sent waves of ice through his veins, and the judgment room swirled as he started to faint. A guard threw a bucket of ice water over him.
Not yet, Pete.
The shock forced the prisoner fully awake, and he squealed like a piglet being dragged to the butcher's block.
Do you honestly think that we should kill a child instead?
Yes! He did it! Not me! Not me!
With a snarl, the Baron dashed the chalice to the concrete floor.
Then you are worse than a thief. You're a coward as well. Your boy may have done the damage, but you, the adult, hid the fact. By the time we discovered the damage, the sandstorm had killed over half the crops in that greenhouse. How many others may die from lack of food because of your cowardice?
Excuse me, High Baron. Furious over the interruption, Gunther turned, his red hair a crimson halo about his distorted features. But when he saw who it was, the man relaxed his posture, and his filaments lay down obediently on his wide shoulders.
Yes, Leonard, what is it?
The teenager bowed respectfully.
We have a problem.
Gunther turned back to the screaming man.
Then handle it, my son. I'm busy at the moment, dispensing justice.
It is a serious problem, sir.
Sir, eh?
The Baron smiled tolerantly.
Very well, then. Let's go.
He turned to the sick man who had revived the fainted prisoner with the bucket of water.
Lieutenant Kilgore, handle that matter.
At once, sir.
Gunther reached for the door latch, but Leonard took his arm.
Father.
He glanced at the writhing prisoner.
I know his crime was terrible, unforgivable. The killing of plants, the stealing of food.
He swallowed, and his voice faltered. Baron Strickland rested a hand on the boy's shoulder until he looked up.
Never be afraid of anything, especially when asking me for a favor. Understood?
Yes, my father.
Is it mercy you wish? For that?
The distaste in the Baron's voice was painfully clear.
A thief and a liar who places the blame of a crime on his own child.
Yes!
Debating the issue, the Baron looked directly at Kilgore. His opinion was also clear on the matter. The weeping prisoner had drawn his knees to his chest, fighting to keep his flesh away from the churning maw of the woodchipper.
I can refuse you nothing, my chosen son. Mercy it shall be.
Leonard took his father's hand and kissed it.
Thank you, father.
Gunther shook off the embrace.
Enough. I'm the Baron, not some mucking high priest. Lieutenant Kilgore, show the criminal mercy.
At once, sir.
Come, lad, to my office, where we can talk in private. We have much to discuss.
The Baron turned, and he left the room with Leonard, who did not notice the sec man removing a Colt 45 blaster from his holster and pointing it straight at the prisoner's head. Kilgore waited until they were out of earshot before pulling the trigger.
Mercy.